this is the moment he said that liberated him, that turned him, like, what was his words here? He says, "You have seen how a man was made a slave. You shall see how a slave was made a man."
Welcome to a special edition of The Buck Starts Here. And yes, I'm leading off the introduction, and I am absolutely terrified to do this because Kyle sets a very high standard for introductions. So we're going to be talking about who I consider one of my favorite Americans. And so Kyle's been very gracious to actually go through and look at all of the, get us like 13 random facts or deep dive facts. So I'm going to try my best Kyle impression. It's going to be difficult, so please deal with me. But welcome to The Buck Starts Here. I'm Eric Mason, the marginal cost to Kyle Hedman's marginal return, Grover to Kyle's Cleveland, the supply to Kyle's demand. So Kyle, we're talking about Frederick Douglass, one of the most photographed men of the 1800s too. One of the most photographed men ever.
Okay, so have you been reading my notes? I think I might have accidentally shared them with you.
You did. If you did, I said it would be wicked funny.
I know, right? So yeah, you said they're deep dive. Now I'm getting a little nervous about this because you told me before we hit the record button here, this is like one of your top, I think number two favorite American.
Yeah, I put it right by Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, I was going to judge myself based on like how many questions you asked that I had to look up. we'll see how this goes. Yeah, I got 13. I think they're lesser known facts. I didn't know any of them. Ray, I consider to be pretty smart. I ran them by her. She knew 4 of the 13, I believe. So
that's, I would expect, Ray's one of those people she should clean sweep it. There's always a chance with her.
Yeah. 13. Right. So yeah. So I guess whenever you want to start, we can start with number one here.
Let's go, brother.
And then it'd be interesting here. I can't wait to see how well I did anticipating your questions. Like, did I do the research and the right stuff? That's that's where I'm really excited to find out.
I think you do fine, my friend.
All right. So let's start with the first fact then. Frederick Douglass, he did not know his own birth date. We think he was born sometime in 1818 based on historic reconstructions. But February 14th is actually a symbolic one that he himself chose.
Born in Haiti. I think his mom was enslaved, and his dad, yes. I believe his dad was actually white.
He did not know his dad. I did have a whole bunch of stuff on the parents actually at the very bottom here. That would have come up first.
It was, even at the time, a controversial quote. So he was married for 40 years to an African-American woman, and then when she passed away, he ended up marrying, I don't want to speculate, but he had a relationship with the woman he ended up marrying, and she was white. And he has a quote that's like, "I married somebody who looked like my mother, and then I married somebody who looked like my father." And I know at that time that was considered controversial. Even today, I think that'd be considered a little controversial.
That's interesting. Okay, so I didn't see that, but I did see a quote here where he said that he didn't know who his father was, but he thought it was his master. He said it was probably his master. The opinion, I think a narrative he said, was that his father was a white man. And then he also said that children were deliberately kept ignorant of their fathers, especially when the father was white.
Yeah, and obviously like a huge Frederick Douglass fan. One of the impactful things is I know his mom died when he was a child, but he used to walk as a kid miles to visit his mom, but he'd only see her like night.
I had that the other way. His mother walked 12 miles to see him.
Ooh, okay. I might have that wrong then. But I know that there was a long distance walk at night.
Oh, wow. That's funny. So Harriet Bailey was her name. Yeah. So Frederick Douglass, I guess, was sent to a plantation as like a child servant. And then his mother was hired out to work at a different plantation. And yeah, she walked that distance to see him very briefly, then passed away when he was still young.
Yeah.
Never knew his dad, so yeah, another one of these great American no father stories.
Yeah, right. Coming up trend.
I know, right? Sadly. Let's see. I was also looking to see if there's any other like well-known parallels of this. And the only one I could find was Booker T. Washington's autobiography, when he also states that he didn't know his exact birth date. Because the quotes that he had in the narrative of Frederick Douglass's made it sound like this was much more commonplace, that most slaves probably didn't know their births, that information was actually like withheld from them as a way to like keep them under control.
It was dehumanizing them.
Right,
exactly. That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, what did he say? He said, by far the large part of the slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs.
Yeah.
He's got a lot
God,
of really
he has
good
amazing
quotes.
Writing style.
Oh my God, I know, right? There's going to be a lot of these, too. All right, so my next fact on here then, too, his literacy started as an accident and then was forcibly stopped. So his mistress, Sophia Auld, is that the right term to use there? I think that's the term he used. I'm going to be careful dancing around some of these terms here. But
sometimes the terminology evolves over time, and that's where... like. It always depends. Like, one of the hardest things we do research for the presidents is trying to modernize. That's why you'll hear us, people who listen to us, like, you'll hear us sometimes use the term Native American, and you'll hear us sometimes use the word Indian. When we're using the word Indian, we're citing something that was expressed at that time in that frame.
Exactly.
So that if you want to go and Google it later, like, if you look at, like, Native American Affairs Bureau, you're not going to, well, Google would probably correct for that, but you would literally not find that source. So, when we use certain terminology, we're using it so you can go correct us or go point or go find or enhance your own research. I mean, there are some uncomfortable words, certainly, but it's not, lack of knowledge is even more uncomfortable.
Well, there's one in here that I'm not going to say, but we'll get to that later.
It's probably a lot. I think anybody who's read his autobiographies would be would be aware of that.
But this instance was really interesting to me. I did not know about this. So Sophia Auld was the mistress of the house. It was the wife to Thomas Auld, who we're going to find out is a terrible, terrible human being.
I mean, but he owned people.
He did a lot worse than that.
Yeah.
If you can believe that. But I guess Sophia did not have, the way that Frederick described her was not having like really understanding like the I guess customs of running a household in this instance, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So when she decided she wanted to be the one to teach him, she tried to teach him how to read, and then the husband found out about it, came in and put a stop to it. He said, if you teach that expletive deleted how to read, there would be no keeping him. That was exact quote from the narrative, or as close as I'm going to get to it.
Yeah.
This is
the
moment.
She almost had like a maternalistic view.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, this was the moment, quoting Frederick Douglass, this was the moment that he understood the pathway to his freedom was going to be through literacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. God, I love Frederick Douglass.
Ah, man. Okay. So I looked up a little bit more about the Alds, too, just to find out a little bit more about them. They're not elite planters. They weren't major political figures. They appear to be stable economically, but not wealthy, just based on Douglass's accounts. He described Sophia Auld as, unaccustomed to the duties of a slaveholder, which would explain why she wouldn't understand why she probably shouldn't teach Frederick how to read. He did encounter Thomas Auld later after he'd escaped. I think he wrote about it in Life of Times in 1892, and he reflected on him as an age diminished, morally diminished, contrasting sharply with his own rise.
How are you morally diminished from when you first meet somebody as a slave owner?
I know,
oh my
right?
God! What are you?
It's kind of a pretty subtle burn there, right?
Did you? I mean, I don't want to skip ahead, but do you have how he earned his freedom? Like how he?
Oh, look at that! Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I don't want to jump in. It's interesting.
All right. So, continuing on with his literacy journey, this is fact number three. Covertly turned white children into his teachers. So he used to. Because he lost his formal education. What he ended up doing was he exploited class divisions among the white children in Baltimore by trading bread for reading lessons from these kids.
That's awesome.
So I got two quotes on here. He used to carry bread with me for many of the poor white children in the neighborhood. This bread I used to bestow upon the hungry little urchins who in return would give me that more valuable bread of knowledge.
I love him.
Right.
An economic solution to a problem.
I know that made me I was thinking about economics and racism, and it's kind of hard to be a racist when the economics are dictating, when you rely on the economics. Right?
Yeah, you very quickly in economics realize that we're all just kind of a bunch of alleles poking around trying to figure out the best way to make more alleles.
What I really wanted to know though is if any of those urchins had a chance to write or reflect upon teaching Frederick Douglass how to read, or if any of them grew up to be like abolitionists or anything like that, you know, right?
Awesome.
You can imagine that was a pretty good exchange for them, right? Trade a little bit of knowledge, get some food.
Yeah, right. I mean, aren't we all doing that?
Right. So the thing that also the rabbit hole I ended up diving into on this one has to do with the etymology of the word urchin.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So the use of it denoting poor children. So the word itself comes from an old French word called herchin, which actually meant hedgehog, that later got generalized to mean a street child. So because they lived in hedgerows and their pig-like snouts and the snuffling sounds that hedgehogs made, that's why they called them hedgehogs. But the word was a French word, was herchin. And that's where the word sea urchin comes from, because they're prickly little, they look like a hedgehog.
That, I love that. Right? Isn't that wild? I love stuff like that.
Yeah. Anyway, so the story about Douglas's literacy turned into a deep dive into urchin etymology.
Dude, that is the rabbit hole of doing this type of research.
Right?
Like, wait, where did that word come from?
All right. Fact number four. Are you familiar with Edward Covey?
No, I don't think so.
He was a slave breaker who was specifically hired to break Frederick Douglass. And his fight...
He did a horrible job. Very bad job.
I will argue he did it, actually, his job, based on Frederick Douglass's own words here. He said the fight with Edward Covey marked his psychological emancipation.
Okay.
So Edward Covey specifically... employed to break enslaved people through sustained violence. So what a breaker would do is they would use systematic violence, surveillance, and psychological terror to force obedience and people. So like this fight, this wasn't just like a one-off fight where they hired this guy, he showed up and then like beat up Frederick Douglass to try to get him to behave. No, this was months of like a terror campaign, and eventually Frederick hit his breaking point, and there was a two-hour like fight with this guy where he tried to like tie him up to restrain him, to whip him, and Frederick Douglass wouldn't let him. He went and got help. He kept resisting that help. From what I read, it sounded like he never actually got whipped again from this point on, but I wasn't able to really confirm that. So
Frederick Douglass won, right?
Frederick Douglass won, but this is the moment he said that liberated him, that turned him, like, what was his words here? He says, "You have seen how a man was made a slave. You shall see how a slave was made a man."
Yeah, so the slave breaker, in my opinion, did a bad job. He made one of the greatest abolitionists of all time. It's like you did the opposite.
He took him to his breaking point, but he forced he broke him into something better. Is what happened.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like accident. It's like you think like the other people were like, dude, what the heck? Look at what he did. He made the greatest abolitionist ever. He made the guy that Lincoln consulted. Like, what are you doing?
So yeah, this guy sounds like a real piece of crap too. By the way, man. But yeah, so he said the battle with Mr. Covey was the turning point in his career as a slave, and it rekindled the few expiring embers of freedom.
Oh, that's great.
Covey ultimately did call for help. Douglass also resisted and then disengaged. And then in his book, My Bondage with My Freedom, in 1855, he recounted the details of this fight in like much more detail.
Everybody should read all three of his autobiographies, for the record. Like, or at least one of them. Just read one of them.
These all look amazing. Yeah.
His writing style is amazing. And it's so unique. There's really, I love autobiographies, and I really haven't been anybody who writes like Douglass.
Yeah. Why isn't he celebrated as like one of the great American writers?
I have no idea. I do not know
why.
Still
got to read The Scarlet Letter. Ugh.
Yeah, which isn't even that good of a book.
No, it's a terrible book.
I want to hear about Frederick Douglass being like, they sent a slave breaker to break me. Oh, and I became the greatest abolitionist ever. It's like, all right, yeah, no, why would I not want to read a book about that guy?
Okay, Eric, so let me ask you a question. For fact number five, do you know how Frederick Douglass escaped slavery?
No, I know he went to New Mexico. He was helped by his wife. I know that. And they know they settled in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Do you know why you don't know?
Why don't I know?
Because he intentionally concealed the details of his escape.
That makes me feel so much smarter than I didn't know that.
Right?
That's sick. That's awesome.
He refused to publish escape details even when he was under pressure. He had argued that publicizing such information endangered others and prioritized collective safety over personal acclaim. And then I also tried to look to see if he ever talked about it, like, after the Civil War, and he still seemed to maintain that. He never really, like, talked about the details of his escape. And I love the quotes on this here, too. I deem it prudent and therefore necessary to withhold the manner of my escape. The practice of publishing minute details has done incalculable harm.
Love him. See, he would be the guy he was involved with the U.S. Marshals, I know that. But he's the guy you want doing intelligence operations, so he's not even giving you a look at that.
Right? So this is, we're getting about to the time now where the narrative book comes out, right? 1845.
Okay.
I think is when that was published. That publication of that book actually made him fear recapture and created a bunch of tensions inside of his movement. I tried to find some information about like how commercially successful the book was, and I couldn't find any details on like sales. All I could find was that it went through multiple reprintings, which is a good sign, obviously. And then also there was the fact that William Lloyd Garrison, and there was a letter of authentication by William Phillips in the first edition, kind of shows that they had meant to market this to a much wider audience of people that, like, yeah.
Yeah, and this is right around the Dred Scott decision, too. So you had this court case, Supreme Court case, that essentially made slavery legal everywhere for all intents and purposes, you know, juxtaposition to this incredibly well-written narrative of a man who was still fearful. I mean, I think it was 1848 when he bought his freedom, something like that.
We're getting there. Don't jump ahead.
Sorry. But it's very interesting. I can't wait to talk about how we got his.
I know.
It's the best part.
Right? So after this book came out, he ended up moving to Great Britain for a couple of years. And that is where we pick him up with his freedom being purchased abroad and without his consent.
Yeah. Awesome. They were just like, this guy's awesome. Why would you? What? This guy's the best.
I'm on his side, though. So whose side are you on that?
What, purchasing his freedom? He went on lecture series and they raised money to purchase his freedom, I believe.
Right. That's but if you look at it from Douglass's side of things, like the way he looks at it is you just validated Thomas Auld's ownership over him by making this payment to him. And plus, the dude's a piece of shit. They gave him £150 sterling.
Oh, my word. That is that's an obscene amount of money.
Yeah, I'd be pissed, too, if I was him.
I am, but I'm also, like, the realist in me is, like, it is a giant middle finger, and I do, like, any time you do stuff like that, like...
So, on the one hand, like, his friends, like, I guess you could say, like, they can take on the burden and let you hold your moral high ground. You don't have to pay for your freedom. You can still reap the benefits and be pissed about it, too.
Yeah, it's like winning a negotiation and then picking up the tab at the dinner.
Right.
There's a little bit of that. Like, I'm good. Yeah, don't worry about me. I won. I don't need to win anymore. There's a little bit of that.
I don't know, though. I mean, I still kind of.
Oh, Kyle, knowing you personally, I could see you totally would not be the guy who would want that. No.
That guy.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's what you'd be like. Give me the money so I can write him letters.
So, what did you know about? Like, did you find, like, who were the people that actually purchased it? I just saw that it was his supporters than the friends that he made when he's over there. Do you know anything more about?
I don't know the exact people's names, but what I remember reading in about it is that he basically did all these lecture tours through like Ireland, Scotland, England, and people were like, this was insane people to hear. You know, at the same time, you know, there was, you know, sometimes we think about slavery as a specifically United States issue, which it was. But in the 1840s, there's still this, you know, globalized, and to this day, there's more slaves in the world today than there was in 1860, but the whole world was struggling with this concept. And it's what I think is interesting is he was portrayed as this, I think he did an excellent job at portraying the complexity of slavery in a broader sense, I think race in America at the time, because he was a man who fled to the north and found, you know, immense support for what he was doing. And obviously this is where we left season two in the presidency. The divide had occurred, and I think what he did a good job talking to the Europeans about, no, there wasn't this homogenous thought in the United States, that like there was these very vocal, and I mean, we talk about it, right? We talk about the Trail of Tears. It wasn't like retrospectively we're like, oh, the Trail of Tears were wrong. It's like, no, at that time, there's a large portion of Americans who the Trail of Tears was wrong. And seeing that represented, especially by Frederick Douglass in outside of the country, I think it did a lot to, I don't want to say support or hurt America's viewpoint or America's perspective or the perspective on America in the world. What I think it did is it added more detail to it. And I think that's valuable in of itself.
That's well said, man. So let's talk about some of the stuff he did then to raise some awareness back in the States then, because when he came back in 1847, he founded the North Star. So he was actually a newspaper editor before he was a celebrity orator.
Yeah. One of the best names for a newspaper of all time.
It's such a good
name, right? Dude. It's a solid name.
And you know what the motto was?
No.
Right is of no sex, truth is of no color.
Yeah, and he was a huge supporter of women's rights.
North Star was one of the ones that published the initial, I got to look up the report name. It was the Seneca Falls report of 1848.
And he was the only man to show up at
He's
Seneca
one
Falls.
One of the few. Was he the only man?
I have always said he was the only man to do it. I don't know if but he was one of the few people there. He also, you may have this in here, but he died shortly after attending. Literally, like, that's one of my favorite people.
Okay. So I did some digging in then onto the North Star because I was actually really curious to see if there is like any version of it that still exists today. And unfortunately, the answer to that is no.
How long did it last? Did you have that?
So in 1851, it merged with the Liberty Paper Party or Liberty Party Paper,
sounds like a party store. I would go and get like trinkets at.
Then they also said it became Frederick Douglass's paper, like that was the name of it after the merger, I think. So that's kind of cool. He remained the editor and principal voice of the publication after the merger, but it kind of like died off. Like he just kind of, it ceased publication before the Civil War, like because of financial constraints, political realignments. And then also Douglass was increasingly taking a lot more speaking roles and getting much more national prominence. So I just think it kind of fell off of his, you know, his, he just didn't have the time for it. Interestingly enough, though, I thought was that a lot of the abolitionists he was working with did not, there was no like, they were like, yeah, we shouldn't have slaves, but they also didn't think they should vote. How do you marry that?
Yeah, so there were, it's interesting because like, and I do a poor job of this when we talk, but I always drive the delineation between abolitionists and emancipators. And I probably incorrectly and openly, probably should be criticized for this, but I often paint emancipators as like watered down abolitionists.
Right, right.
They kind of are. Now, the journey of Frederick Douglass's view on the Constitution relative to slavery is fascinating. It's a very interesting perspective. But there was this whole thing, but day plus one. Now, I'm sure we've all heard the old saying, revolutionaries become conservatives the day after the revolution's done. there was a little bit of that in the abolition movement. Like, you had pure abolition. You had the John Quincy Adamses, right? You had the guy who was like, all men are created equal. But no but. And it stops at that sentence. We're all created equal, right? That's end of story. We all have the same rights, same rules, nothing. And that is if John Quincy Adams was not previously a president and largely like the smartest man of his time, probably would have been taken as a more radical stance. I'm sure people try to argue that with John Quincy Adams and they're just like, oh, he's just smarter than me.
Yeah.
Like, I think there was probably a lot like, we're just not going to argue this. Also, he's hilarious and just constantly trolling people. But that wasn't, it was not, there was not homogenous thought in there at all. I mean, there was people who viewed, and I do want to get a little detail. It wasn't always contextualized as a race issue. It was, sometimes it was like, you have these, you know, the camps are the, you know, people who want franchisement and the people who don't want freed slaves to be, franchised into the voting population. Now, one of the things actually arose during this time period were people saying, well, women, if white women don't have the right to vote, why should black men have the right to vote?
Oh, that's why he tied them together.
That's why he was so involved with the women's suffrage movement.
One of the favorite things that I heard from Ray talking about consent, because that comes up again a little bit later here too, about people doing things for him without his consent.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it's rich that somebody who complains about, you know, people buying his freedom without his consent just inserted himself into the women's rights movements without being invited.
Yeah. So that type of, there was a lot of, I don't have like direct polling data, but, and again, I mean, I'm sure people have read this, so I'm not saying anything that's like radical here, is that there was this idea of that you could be anti-slavery, and then there was still a large portion that did not support, franchisement of any group that wasn't landowning white men. Then there's even groups that were like, it wasn't a white thing or a race thing. It was, you had to own land. Yeah. Then there was even some who were like, it's a wealth thing. It got really weird. Like with anything, the more you zoom in on it, the more you start to see wider gaps between the individual factions.
Yeah. That is something that maybe we should do when we do our Civil War series, is maybe dive into some of the political parties.
Yeah, I mean, voting is a crazy evolution because, I mean, you have women voting in the territories. You know, the first woman, some of the first, like, women to vote were in, like, the 1600s in the United States in, like, the old, like, town hall. I don't even call it town hall voting. All the way up to, like, you know, modern, you know, enfranchisement and stuff like that is still a bizarre discussion. Globally, but even in the Western world, we still... I mean, people would be surprised if you look at some European countries when women finally got the right to vote.
It's
very recent.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild.
You ready for a new fact?
Yeah. I always like new facts.
All right. Frederick Douglass publicly broke with William Lloyd Garrison over the Constitution is the fact title on here, which I don't know if that's the way I like to phrase this one.
This is very interesting. This is super interesting.
I was kind of fascinated. So first of all, I had to look up who William Lloyd Garrison was. He was a very prominent abolitionist.
Yeah.
He also was not like a politician. I think he kind of positioned himself more as like a prophet or a man of God. You kind
he's close to MLK than he would be to say like John Quincy Adams.
Right. Okay. So I think one of his speeches, like he called the Constitution a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. Yeah, it sounds very prophetic.
Benjamin Franklin probably wouldn't 100% disagree with that, just for the record.
But I mean, so... I guess William Lloyd Garrison had basically decided that the Constitution should be interpreted as a pro-slavery document.
Yes.
I had to look up his reasoning for this because I don't agree with him at all. Like the way I read the Constitution, it looks like a document that's for liberation for everybody.
Sounds very Frederick Douglass-y right now.
I know, right? Well, Frederick Douglass initially supported his views. Garrison's arguments were based on three points that I have listed. The Three-Fifths Clause is one of them. Yep. The Fugitive Slave Clause being another one, and then the protection of the international slave trade until 1808. But the Three-Fifths Clause and the Fugitive Slaves Acts were added later, right? That wasn't part of the initial Constitution as it was drafted, right?
I thought the Fugitive Slave Act was like seven years after it.
Definitely way later, right?
Three-fifths, I believe, was that in part the original Constitution. Oh, yeah, because that's how they came up with the House. Right. I mean... continue because you're gonna hit Frederick Douglass's viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, the protection of the international slave trade until 1808. It ended in 1808 is another way to look at that, right? Yeah, I think that right there tells you the movement or the direction they were trying to move towards.
Yeah, it's so a lot of like political historians I've read have referred to this discussion as the Constitution is an emancipation document.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, and also Three-Fifths Compromise is anti-slavery,
right? Because
you're reducing the population.
The population, yeah.
Yeah, that's a weird thing that people would be like. It sounds like arguing for. I know it's oxymoronic, and this is, dude. You know me. I could be an absolutist sometimes, man.
Right.
That like, oh, you're degrading that population. Well, it's like, no. It's not saying. It's not saying that an individual is worth three-fifths. What it's saying is that the representation of a whole individual only counts for three-fifths when it comes to assigning seats in the House, which therefore reduces the number of seats by slave-holding states, which weakens their power congressionally.
Yes.
And then, like, it's weird because I'm like, after 1808, like you have the USS Constellation, the famed USS Constellation, that was out there, you know, sinking slaves. You know, I don't know if they sunk slave ships. There's a very interesting documentary that was done like 20 years ago that's on this.
But how they sent over like Trinidad and Tobago and like wrecked a...
Yeah, I mean, we also went to the coast of Africa with it too. But not wanting to attack. So like America became like very good at boarding slave ships.
Did you see anything that explained like why Douglass reversed his position? Because...
I think this is one of the things I love about Douglass. I think he was never static. I don't think he ever let his previous opinions dictate what his opinions had to be in the future. And I think that's one of the many things I love about Frederick Douglass is that it evolved over time.
See, my thought was that he needed – I think he just agreed with a guy in order to get what he needed. And then once he was able to like branch out and on his own, then he was able to kind of have his own ideas. It's kind of like Martin Van Buren stepping out from under Jackson's.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'd go that far with the Machiavellianism. Like I would say like personally, like I'm just obviously – different thing, but like my views in economics have changed a lot over my life. They've changed a lot from when I, you know, first started studying economics to today. And I look back at things I thought of are almost polar opposite where I am now.
Right.
And one of the things I always tell my students is I'll be sending out the email in a couple of days, again, whenever this comes out. But I always tell my students that economics is going to make you feel uncomfortable. And if you ever get over that feeling of uncomfortability, please let me know because I'm still struggling with it. There's a lot of really heated opinions I had about economics in my 20s. And I'm not talking like broad. I'm talking like very narrowed down opinions on economics that I know now I look back and I'm like, no. I don't believe that anymore. I don't think, because evidence has changed. My interpretation has changed on it. Like, the time to think on a subject and metabolize it changes it, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. You forget about all the years of experience that you have that filters the change. Filters that narrative.
I can see Frederick Douglass as he's matured and as he's had time to think. Imagine a bigger brain. Doing that. So,
yeah. Okay. All right.
Or maybe it was all Machiavelli. You're 100% right, Kyle. I mean, I never doubt human nature.
I mean, I think there might be some of that to it. Like, it's kind of when you're new to something, right? You're kind of just glad to be around. It kind of takes a little bit to find your own footing and maybe find your own voice. And I was wondering if maybe just a little bit of that. Because, I mean, I like the way he said he came around to it in 1852. He said, interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document. And I agree with him on that.
Yeah. It's one of the things I also loved about Frederick Douglass is that he has these revolutionary ideas. He has his ideas to interpret, especially, you know, as we're only in the 1852, it gets even more interesting as life gets along.
Getting really interesting in this next one.
Yeah, is that he has this ability to, he's not a radical. Like, he's not, what he has is these fundamental moralist beliefs, and morality seems radical in immoral times. He's not a radical himself. He just has this very, I would argue, centrist belief. It's obvious, like, dude, everybody knows how much I love John Quincy Adams. It should be no surprise I love Frederick Douglass because they're basically the same dude of just being like, this is right. Yeah, but what about, no, not about anything. Nope. This is the correct thing to do.
Yes. So, next, this is the one that stumped Ray, and I was actually really surprised about this, but you kind of alluded to it a minute ago when we opened this, when you said he was the most photographed man of the 19th century.
Yeah,
he treated photography as a tool of political resistance. So at a
that
time
that famous
when
picture of him is inherently
there are so many of those pictures, and I tell you what, man, I put a lot of thought into like what sweater I was going to wear. I almost wore a tie, and like, cause I was like, man, if somebody's going to be like this,
stay like white streak in your hair.
Dude, he looks sharp, man, and all those the suits that he's got, man. So as you mentioned, him being like the most photographed man in the 19th century.
You know, most photographed man. It is funny. He did use it as a tool.
Yeah. I mean, so if we – I think we spent a little bit of time maybe – I don't want to pull up them, but caricatures. There's a lot of caricatures being printed in newspapers. And if you think about like where people get their news and their information from, there's not a lot of books around. There's not a lot of – like where are you going to get your representation of what somebody like Frederick Douglass looks like? Right. And he combated that by going on in 1861. He did a whole tour, a speaking tour called Pictures in Progress, where he went around and did a series of lectures just showing photographs of himself and basically just telling everybody, like showing everybody that, you know, he was distinguished. He was not what these caricatures depicted him as, just showed him as like a real person, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's like the humanization of
that.
Him.
That.
It's so cool to me. Like,
right.
Here's something. All right. So a little off topic, but another obviously came in later, younger than Frederick Douglass is W.B. Du Bois. And I'm not sure if it still is, but the largest, at one point, the largest academic library in the United States was named after W.B. Du Bois. It's obviously still named after, I'm not sure if it's the largest, but it's a UMass Amherst library. But wild fact, so he's born like 1868, something like that. He died in 1963. And he was like a contemporary, not contemporary because Fred Douglass was older, but they existed around the same time.
They overlapped.
They overlapped for almost 30 years. It's cool to think of like somebody who was like contemporary to Douglass also living into the 1960s.
Watched Kennedy get assassinated.
Yeah, it was like right around that time. Actually, right? I think that's like right when he was very similar time. So yeah, he's... But one of the things that I think Douglass was very powerful when it came to, you know, that discourse is W.D. Du Bois and Frederick Douglass existed on, I don't want to be trivializing this, but relatively existed on different ends of the spectrum when it comes to race relations in the United States, and how do you move on from the Civil War. And I think something that makes Frederick Douglass very interesting is that his prominency was the span of the Civil War through northern occupation of the South all the way into the Jim Crow era. And it's interesting to see his use of himself, his use of his imagery, and his use of his excellent speaking ability to kind of create, I know this sounds very weird, but like a pre-antebellum goals of the abolition movement, of the emancipation movement, that extends into Jim Crow. And it's almost like you're watching the Jim Crow era. It's almost like he showed himself, presented himself as not only just like he's aging, he'll be still doing, still a great orator, still doing all that stuff. But it's cool to see that kind of like, here's what we thought prior to the freeing of slaves, to almost 40 years after the slaves are freed, in his consistent, and I mean this word in both ways, his consistent image on that, of both him, that those ideals aging and being placed and some abandoned, some new ideas popped up, but that consistency, that must have been bizarre, right? Like, you're sitting there, you could be looking at Frederick Douglass in the 1880s, you go hear him talk, and you're being connected to somebody who shaped emancipation in the United States, abolitionism. That's the other thing. Like,
a little more than that, too.
What's that?
There's a little bit more. He shaped a little bit more than that. I got some more facts to bring up.
Well, I was just going to end it with, it is weird that we talk about the emancipation movement in the United States. There was no emancipation movement. There was an emancipation movement. The U.S. didn't, slavery wasn't emancipated. It was abolished. And I always think that's very weird. Like, oh, the emancipation of the, no.
But it's the Emancipation Proclamation that I think
that throws people off.
Everybody, yeah.
Which, by the way, was an abolitionist thing. There was no. It was Abraham Lincoln be like, hey, slave states, you don't have slaves anymore. That's not emancipation. That's just abolitionism. You abolished the thing. It wasn't the slow progressive. It wasn't like if the Emancipation Proclamation was, oh, all slaves born after this date are now free, that would be the Emancipation Proclamation. Yes. I mean, I think that was a piece of political decorum by Mr. Lincoln.
Oh, that's,
we're not
going to
call it the abolitionist. Yeah. We're going to call it the emancipation. It's like, dude, saying you can no longer have slaves is abolitionism. So, like, yeah, I do find that funny that we still have that in the lexicon, by the way. We still talk about the emancipation movement in the United States. I'm like, but we didn't emancipate the slaves. No. We abolished slavery. It was an abolitionist success. The guy who did it was Abraham Lincoln, who was a member of the Republican Party, which was founded on not literally was an anti-emancipation, pro-abolitionist party. It was very, I do like that. But I think it's so cool that there was that Frederick Douglass created that bridge over time. That must have been wild to be able to talk to somebody like that.
Oh, man, right? I mean, you mentioned the books too. Again, I just want to throw one more. I need to go pick these up, but yeah, they span from 1845 to 1892. So you get a 40-year look at his. Man, I need to go read these. All right, ready for fact number 11? We're almost through these. You kind of hinted at this a little bit again. I feel like you're reading my list here. Confronted Abraham Lincoln directly about his viewpoints in his Life and Times in 1892. He said, "I felt it my duty to tell him frankly what I thought of his course." And then he also said in his presence, he was never in the slightest degree reminded of his color. And I thought that was kind of cool, too.
Yeah.
Well, get to the items here. So he engaged with them critically. He pressed them on emancipation and black enlistment. There's three core disagreements that I was able to find here. The first one was the immediate and unequivocal emancipation. So Douglass argued that slavery was not just a cause of the war, but a moral crime that demanded direct action. The enlistment of black soldiers, which he insisted that formerly enslaved men should be allowed to fight for their own freedom and for the Union cause, and then for equal treatment of the black troops.
Equal pay, too. That was a big one.
Yep. Yeah. He condemned discriminatory pay, assignments, and recognition for black soldiers once enlisted. And I've also put together a scorecard.
A scorecard of what? Frederick Douglass?
Oh, of how these three points ended up resolving.
Oh, I do like that.
All right. So
I get to do my Massachusetts victory lap after this, though.
Yes. So let me get through these, and then you can have your four. So the Emancipation Proclamation, as we mentioned, issued as a war measure. It freed enslaved people and rebelling slaves. This was in 1863. It aligned with Lincoln's frameworks, but advanced Douglass's central demand for emancipation. Douglass did support it, but he did criticize its limits. Yeah. I believe this was only for rebelling states. This didn't free slaves who were living in the North. Or
Maryland
anywhere else,
or
right?
Missouri, both slave states, yeah.
Yeah. So in the authorization of black enlistment, the Union Army did formally enlist black soldiers, including the 54th Massachusetts. Douglas
Glory of the famous movie Glory.
Yes, there you go. Douglas actively recruited black men, so it signaled that he was partially aligned with the advocacy and the policy. The movements towards equal pay, this is the one he probably did the weakest on, but black soldiers did initially receive lower pay. Congressional actions did later move towards pay equalization, and that was reflected from sustained pressure from black leaders, including himself. Yeah. And then the 13th Amendment in 1865, the permanent abolishment of slavery that had exceeded Lincoln's early limited war measures and framings and fulfilled the core of Douglas's longstanding argument. Douglas wins 3-0.
Yeah, I mean, the famous Lincoln quote, right? If I could free all the slaves and save the Union, I would. If I could keep all the slaves and save the Union, I would. If I could do a mix and save the Union, I would. So, Lincoln was anti-slavery. He was. Mm-hmm. I don't like this revisionist that's coming up like, oh, maybe. No. But he was a unionist first.
Yes.
And that's, I do, you know, as much as we were, you know, goofing around a little earlier, I mean, like, he was an emancipator, but he wasn't an absolutist emancipator. He did believe in abolitionism, right? That's why they rebelled. Like, it's so, right. We think of history very flat. Like, we think of it as very, all the, no, like, they, the South was terrified when Lincoln got elected.
Because they should have been.
Yeah, because they're like, they didn't view him as, he may have, in his heart, he may have had this, you know, confliction because he thought he was going to be the worst president of all time. Which is ironic that he's the best president of all time, flanked by the two worst presidents of all time.
That's what happens when you have the worst one right before you.
And then the worst one immediately after you. And, you know, it is fascinating because Lincoln was Union first and then viewed, you know, he did not view slavery as something that could exist permanently and it must be addressed because it threatens the Union. Where, again, going back to what I mentioned earlier, what we talked earlier about from Frederick Douglass, right? He's a moralist. He's like, this is right.
Yep.
This is right.
Yep.
You're all the Union. No. It's just, this is the correct thing to do. Adjust around this.
Yes.
Frederick Douglass.
Ah, man. Yeah, do you want to change your ranking by any chance?
For what? Douglass?
You still have Lincoln number one?
Yeah, I still have Lincoln number one. Because there's
Douglass just owned him in this.
I mean, he also didn't have the pressures of being the president. Here's my other thing, like, fought the bloody, you know, you had the bloodiest war of all time in U.S. history, right? And like within 20 years no sorry within like 16 years largest economy in the world.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Hasn't relinquished it. Like,
yeah,
you think Rutherford B. Hayes, Andrew Johnson, I love Ulysses Grant, oh crap on Ulysses Grant, you think those three dudes were the reason we became the largest economy? And you think it was Mr. Lincoln, right? Yeah, I still think that's the biggest what if in history, if he wasn't assassinated. I still think that is.
That'd be a fun one. We should play that game when we get to that episode.
Yeah, it is. I don't know what would happen because you wouldn't have the Andrew Johnson presidency. Mm. Like, you wouldn't have that. And, like, would you probably still have Jim Crow? Like, maybe, but there's a lot of festering that Andrew Johnson did. And in Grant, I mean, Grant was a good president, but even Grant couldn't clean that out.
Yeah.
And you wonder if you had Lincoln in there. Like, what would have happened? And it's not even that if Lincoln was there, it's that if it wasn't Andrew Johnson, who don't understand why Andrew Johnson gets like a slide where, like, I think it's people forget about him. And it's
we'll shine the light, don't worry.
Oh, it's just gonna be, he's not gonna be Jackson, but it's gonna be damn close. You sucked. You made every wrong decision you could
every
possibly
Andrew
make.
Sucks. All right. Fact number 12. This is, we're wrapping up here. This is probably we'll have one more bonus one after this, but.
Oh, okay.
Final public act, again, circling back to women's suffrage, was advocating for women's suffrage.
Yeah.
The day that he died, February 20th, 1895, he was attending a women's suffrage meeting in Washington, D.C., reaffirming his lifelong support for women's rights. So he ended up having, I think it was a massive heart attack, like hours after this event happened.
Bad time in existence to have a massive heart attack.
I know, right? But, I mean, depending on when he actually was born, he still lived a pretty full life, right?
It's crazy.
Nearly 70 years, right?
Yeah.
Like, depending on when he actually was born.
Yeah, he was in his, it'd be like late 70s, yeah.
Yeah. But, 77,
something like that.
And then one more bonus fact, then, just to wrap things up here. I mean, we talked about how he had gotten the presidential nomination, I think, in the past episode.
Yeah.
Right? Actually, two of them, right? He also was nominated for vice president in 1872.
Oh, that's fire.
Also without consent.
I love that. Kyle, you didn't include that he was a U.S. Marshal at one point?
No, I didn't even get to that one.
He was a marshal in D.C. Yeah. Because he's the most interesting American ever to live.
Right. Well, you're going to these... Previously, we mentioned that he had the presidential nomination votes in 1848 and 1888. And then in another one, the 1888, I think that one was actually the only one he seemed to accept.
It was kind of like a symbolic thing. I didn't know he accepted any of them. That's awesome. Yeah, that's sick.
The first one, he was like, I don't know about this. Like, I'm actually voting for the other guy. 1848, was that the one he supported? Martin Van Buren, I think?
Yeah, I believe that was Martin Van Buren.
And then in 72, he was like, I support Grant. I don't know what you guys are doing here. Like, leave me out of this, please.
Yeah, because I'm very happy that history is turned the corner on Grant.
Okay, so in 1888, Kentucky African Americans database, he received one vote from the Kentucky delegation in Chicago, marking a milestone as the first black person to receive a vote for president at a major party convention.
Dude, that's sick.
Supporting Senator John Sherman, Douglas accepts this symbolic vote. 1872 Equal Rights Party is the one who nominated him as the vice president. He was not informed of it, did not acknowledge or participate in the campaign, largely because he supported the Republican Party and disapproved of the unconventional nature of that campaign.
Yeah, he had this weird thing about, like, he never really addresses it too heavily, but you could tell he definitely hates, like, the symbolic stuff. Like,
right?
He just has a thing about, like...
I did it a few times to him, it seems like. He doesn't seem to... Well, they keep doing it in his name without talking to him or consulting with him. I can see why he'd be against it.
He also has a great name.
Right?
It's a top, like, five name in U.S. history.
Okay, so you have a bonus fact, then tell me about this Marshall thing.
He was a sworn Marshal in D.C., and, like, I just... I would argue probably the most famous U.S. Marshal of all time.
No. What was the other one that has his own television show now? That Bass Reeves. That was the name I was trying to think of.
Never heard of that.
You've never heard of Bass Reeves?
Bass Reeves was Frederick Douglass.
As a Marshal?
Oh, okay. Never mind. Yeah, no, you're right about that. Sorry. We were talking about
Marshals at this point, I thought.
it's fascinating. Kyle and I, before the show, I was very excited about this when Kyle floated the idea. Frederick Douglass, I would say, is, even though he was not an economic figure of his time, I've always been a nerd. And I was like 13 or 14 years old, and my parents had given me like a book, and it was like, I forget what it was on. It was like Famous Americans, something like that. I probably have it on my bookshelf back there. but it's like something I'm going to like read to my daughter, right? Yeah. Something that like, really early on in her life. Where she has no idea to understand the concepts. But there was something funny, and it's something that I've said. I'm sure there's other videos and stuff from conferences I've spoken at where I've said this. And it's a totally stolen from Frederick Douglass. Where Frederick Douglass said, there is no freedom without economic freedom. That you can free people. But if you do not give them the right to manage their own resources and use their own resources, it means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, that has made me more of a modern Austrian than reading Friedrich Hayek, than reading economic textbooks. Nothing has affected my, and this is me being self-serving right now, nothing has affected my view on what economics is supposed to do. Economics is about maximizing scarce resources, maximizing the welfare of an individual. And reading about Frederick Douglass, who is somebody who I'd always seen in a historical, in a political sense, you know, as you grow up, you know, you're in eighth grade, you get a little textbook, and you do the section on Frederick Douglass, right? And then as you're older, you're kind of exposed to these ideas. That has stuck with me for my whole life, right? That has influenced like every talk I've given, every paper I've written, every class I've taught in economics. Is this centrist idea that I can never really, I've never found a way to escape from it, which is, he's 100% right that if you can give people what they think are all the freedoms in the world, right? Freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of association, right? You can give all those to people. But if they don't have access to their own resources, if somebody else is holding the purse strings, you're not free.
No.
You're living in a synthetic dictatorship, right? Like, and I don't know. And it's so funny because Frederick Douglass, I shouldn't love him as much as I do as an economic figure. He did so much that just being a civil rights leader, just being like one, being literally one of the greatest Americans ever to live, that should be enough. But I look at him, I'm like, he's also a great economist. Like, he's also great. I love this guy. No, I just, that's one of the many reasons. I've loved Frank like my whole life. I think he's great. I remember we were at, when I visited UMass as a junior in high school, I was talking to one of my teachers and I was like, so the library, I see W.B. Du Bois. And I'm like, that's crazy. Why is it named after W.B. Du Bois? It should be named after Frederick Douglass. Right. Like, well, he's from Gardner, Massachusetts. And I'm like, yeah, but W.B. Du Bois left. He waited until, just before he passed away. But he went to, I think it was Liberia at the time. Part of Liberia that's not part of Guyana. Where, like, Frederick Douglass focused very heavily on how do we move on? How do we make sure women can vote? Like, it never stopped. He won. Like, he got abolished slavery.
Yes. And he kept going.
And he kept going because he was just such a moralist. Yes. He loved America. He loved the Constitution. But he didn't just accept it as like, well, this is the status quo. He always strived for that bigger moral bound, What would have been better to name a library? You could literally not name a library after somebody better than him. Like, he had nothing, literally nothing. He didn't even have a mom growing up, right? Yeah. And he ended up becoming the greatest orator.
The most famous person of the 19th century,
yeah,
I think, right?
The greatest orator.
Yes. Gave Lincoln notes.
Yeah, right. One of the best political scientists ever to live. And he accomplished all his goals. And what did he die doing? He died trying to push the next group forward. And I'm like, this should be states named after this guy. Like, right? I think it's a shame that we don't convey that to the next generation of being like, you want to look at what a great American looks like? It's that guy. Yeah. It's that guy. It's the amazing head of hair with the white stripe. That is just iconic. All right. It's right. Great. I'm sorry. I know I didn't want to go on a rant. Well, I did. I was going on a rant. But like,
love your brands.
God, he's just the best. And did he have more? Were there more shortcomings in terms of his personal life? Yes. So does everybody. Literally, there is not a single person you can pick in American history that you probably can't find something that they weren't. No person is perfect, right?
Don't dig through my past, please.
Yeah, I was gonna have to. But yeah, I'm very appreciative of the honestly blown out of the. I knew you were going to do a great job, man, because I know how you are. But oh my god, this was excellent.
Was there anything in there that you actually didn't know before we started?
Definitely on the level of detail. I like the stuff you went into his time in Europe. My one sentence on Europe was just I knew it was like lectures. I don't want to say he didn't know they paid for it. I didn't know it was as volatile. He was against it.
Oh, like really against it. Like, what was the actual quote he had on there? I did not like the idea of having myself regarded as property. Was his quote?
See, I was unaware of that. Yeah, that's about
right. That's a fire quote too.
Yeah. No, it's just certainly. I mean, obviously, I wanted to do 800 more hours devoted to Massachusetts in this. I did want to talk about the 54th. I did want to talk about the...
I tried to not encroach too much on, because a lot of this stuff was stuff we're coming into, right? We just kind of started touching on Douglass. We're starting to kind of cross paths with him, thinking like the Polk and Pierce episodes. So it felt like I didn't want to take away any of your like stuff from coming up here in the next coming episodes.
Oh, no, you did great. And one of the sweetest things I think about this is if you Google Douglas Civil War, you get Frederick Douglass, not Stephen Douglass.
Good.
And I think that's a little bit of a be,
right.
That's a little bit of a little bit of a fun one. Yeah. That picture, that is just he's just.
Dude, there's so many of them too. All right, you want to wrap us up? Read us an outro.
Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us for this very Freaky Friday style. Stole that from Kyle. Very Freaky Friday style episode. As you can tell, Kyle is clearly better at this than me on the research and interesting parts. So maybe we can convince Kyle to come back for the special topics. We can flip roles again.
Dude, it's terrifying me on this end of it. Like, I don't know what you're going to ask. Like, did I get deep enough? I don't know.
Excellent. So thank you. We're going to be starting season 3 soon. We're going to be leading off with the exact opposite of Frederick Douglass, Jane Buchanan.
Oh, that's right. We got to do that.
Yeah, it really stinks. We're going to go from this really great high of like, here's what you should strive to be, to somebody who I don't think deserves a presidential library if he has one. I hope he doesn't.
Like, I don't think he did. I tried to look for Pierce's. I mentioned you said you thought he had one close to you, but I couldn't find any mention of it.
I forget which college campus it is, because I actually don't think it's Franklin Pierce University. It's part of it's a college campus library.
Ah,
so it's not a narrow library.
Okay.
But thank you everybody for joining. This is an absolute blast. I think give Kyle love for this because again, this is his first time doing this show, doing this style, and absolutely freaking crushed it. So great job, Kyle. Thank you, buddy. And everybody have a good night or good rest of the day.
Woo! Nice work, dude. Produced by China Shop Productions.